The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, Girls Trip. Increasingly, Black women from all walks of life are considering using psilocybin, or magic mushrooms, as part of their healing and self-care journeys, and for a good reason. I feel the lasting effect of just being more loving, more patient, seeing that we all are connected and that people are hurting. It gives me a new perspective. The next article is titled, My First Shroom Trip. My first trip was equal parts liberating and terrifying. I felt every emotion present in the body, but I'd also never felt so lonely and so sad and vulnerable. Francetta J., 30 years old. My first trip was very calming and beautiful. My husband and I microdosed, and I felt a sense that everything was going to be okay. Everything has a way of working out. Maria G., 30. My first trip was ethereal. I was in Amsterdam in 2006, and I had some shrooms from the tea shop. It was a very internal experience. Things you don't get to really explore in yourself all came to the forefront as I journeyed with shrooms. That lightness, that ease, that grace, that peace. Jasmine B., 43. My first trip was everything I wanted it to be. I was with friends, and we all wanted to have fun. We took the mushrooms, and it was like my capacity to love and love more expanded. I had never had this much depth and clarity in my love for people. It was a catalyst to my awakening. Tina M., 25. The next article is titled, Black to the Future. The Music, Feminism, Fashion, and Politics of the 1970s are inspiring a new cultural shift. The well of 2000s nostalgia may be running dry, with every airbrushed crop top, baby pink miniature handbag, and mangled movie remake. It becomes increasingly evident that the usual jackpot is little more than a rusty, empty safe, even without the lint and cobwebs. To say that we overdid the era is an understatement. Well-known fashion and beauty brands, marketing ghouls, fledgling musicians, and television deities, need I go on, squeezed every ounce of natural glamour from the early aughts. I would say it's been hectic to witness personal nostalgic interest being juiced for capitalistic gain, but that would be downplaying the actual hecticness that has been the recent global experience. Fortunately, pop culture contributors have a piping, quote unquote, new decade to explore. One that's not untouched, but is still exciting. Welcome back to the 1970s, baby. Try not to spill any yak on your leisure suit. Beyoncé's renaissance could be deemed the catalyst for appreciation of the 70s, from the percussionist hand claps to thinned out, breathy vocals to a production switch that makes you want to twirl in a fitted Bob Mackie gown. The superstar's time machine successfully ushered in a freer love. Born in 1981, Beyoncé grew up with a clear reverence for the decade before her birth. I mean, the early 1980s were a bit of a continuation of the 70s, with disco's flame not quite extinguished and a flash of its warmth still in the room, and with Jimmy Carter wrapping up his soul sentence in the White House. Think of it like the few stragglers circling the dance floor a few moments after closing. The glitter was still on the floor, even as the bartender was sweeping up the remnants of a good time. From Beyoncé's first album, she told us about the time she held dear. The crashing cymbals and heavy horns on Crazy in Love, and the deliciously almost raunchy nature of Naughty Girl were early proof of her allegiance. We also can't ignore that her debut theatrical film role, Austin Powers in Goldmember, and her first solo single, Work It Out, were funny, funky odes to the 1970s. With Renaissance, though, there was no tie-in to another cultural happening. It was all her, and she proudly laid her influence bare. It caught on like wildfire, but the public had already eased into bowing down to the slinky 70s in more ways than one. Silk Sonic, the musical duo composed of the always anachronistic Bruno Mars and soul meister Anderson .Paak, are believed to be top contenders in the Album of the Year category for upcoming Grammys. The angle for their album, An Evening with Silk Sonic, is songs you'd hear at a dimly lit roller rink in your hometown. The duo joins performers like Kirby, Liv.E, Steve Lacy, and India Sean, who are all bringing back the soul and swagger of the 70s. How I wish I could travel back in time to be a voice in the cultural and love revolution that was the 1970s, says R&B singer Sean. An era in music that elevated Afrocentrism, celebrated Black love and liberation, and oozed sensuality. Her debut album, 2022's Before We Go Deeper, blends funk and the spirit of Motown, even pulling .Paak in for quote-unquote moving on. A songwriter, Sean uses the lyrics of soul music's masters as her compass. The articulation of love in the lyrics of Stevie Wonder, Curtis Mayfield, the Isleys, Roberta Flack, and Marvin Gaye felt scriptural, leaving an emotional imprint of future generations, she says. I think on how those artists so boldly used their voices to bring awareness to social injustices and did so atop the funkiest bass lines. My soul's musical mission is to carry the legacy of love, truth, freedom, and power that was birthed from 70s soul music. In the fall of 1970, thousands of women took to the streets of New York City. The group came together on the 50th anniversary of women gaining the right to vote, which Black women did not earn until 1965. The task at hand was part celebration, part call to action, as equality was still far from a reality. The Women's Strike for Equality was the brainchild of Betty Friedan, the author of the 1963 book, The Feminine Mystique. The text explored the non-fulfillment of post-World War II housewives, encouraging them to find purpose in a career. But as with the women's suffrage movement that Friedan later sought to honor, her most famous work muted the voices of Black women, most of whom were already working outside the home. We know that Black feminism was happening before Black feminism ever became a term, says Jamie Swift, the executive director of Black Women Radicals and an assistant professor of political science at James Madison University. In the 1970s, you were finding people, particularly Black women, emerging from the civil rights era. Black women were coming from the church, coming from these organizations, but they were not being heard. Then they go to this cadre of white feminists, and they're not being heard where they are either. If the second wave of feminism arrived in 1970, stamped by the women's strike in August of that year, the Me Too movement has been deemed the fourth wave of feminism. In essence, Me Too was an opportunity for women to speak out about the sexual violence they faced, especially in corporate and entertainment spaces. Though detractors have tried to dilute the movement and rope the cause in with cancel culture, it is still a force of justice reverberating through Hollywood. It was a Black feminist activist, Tarana Burke, who coined the phrase Me Too and gave the movement its framework. She has remained focused on giving voice to Black and brown women and girls who are survivors of sexual violence. Yet when actress Alyssa Milano tweeted about Me Too in October 2017, the general public was unaware of Burke's work. Though Burke has since been credited for her efforts, the origin of Me Too is still fuzzy for some people. Once again, Black women are having to fight to be heard. They say style repeats itself every 20 years, but I believe the style of the 70s is something that stuck around since its debut, says Brie Malandro, a pop culture archivist. From the flare jeans to the crop tops to layered haircuts with flipped ends and platform heels. My grandmother, Dolores, a proud woman with a sharp tongue and a killer closet, turned 20 in March 1972. She doesn't believe in getting rid of clothes. Gray suede boots, a mustard leather skirt, and loosely fitted plaid tops still take up space in her closet. Not because she likes to hold on to things too tightly, but because she knows garments always come back in vogue. Every woman needs a good pantsuit, is something my grandmother has been saying to me since my teens. According to my social media timelines, she's right. For Michael Kors' Fall/Winter 2022 collection, the luxury brand placed model Adut a Kitsch in a breathable marigold pantsuit. 3 hours before I type this, fashion retailer Nasty Gal shared a post of a fashion influencer wearing their olive green faux leather suit. Creeping to their website will let you see their velvet flared pants leg and satin and belted blazers. According to Elle magazine, America is returning to the office and thus power suits are on the rise. New York Times fashion critic Vanessa Friedman predicted the power suits return back in May, writing, "Odds are the tailored blazer and suit are about to make a comeback. Judging from the recent Balasinga show held at the New York Stock Exchange, which was heavy on the white-collar wear, not to mention the variety of jackets visible even on the red carpet in Canes. This echoes a time when the number of black women in clerical roles was on the uptick, and the need for suits was rising too. The Instagram hashtag 70s fashion also includes over 1.5 million posts of striped sweaters, floral prints, and corduroy bucket hats. Who said you can't add spice to a suit? Shirley Chisholm made history in 1968 when she became the first black woman nominated to Congress. 4 years later, she made an even more daring political move when she ran for president. Though she lost the Democratic nomination to George McGovern, her campaign ushered in an unprecedented number of black women in political office. I think having had the courage and the political will to be a fiercely independent, as she said, unbossed and unbought candidate paved the way for black women running for everything after that, says Crystal Hudson, a council member for New York City's 35th City Council District. When I asked Hudson about the political parallels between the 70s and 2022, she comments, "I think about the environment that folks were in then and the environment that we are in now. You were coming out of the civil rights movement then. You were coming out of protests against the Vietnam War. Now we're coming out of a global pandemic. Black Lives Matter protest after George Floyd's murder. The fall of Roe versus Wade. It feels like similar times. It also speaks to those moments when there's so much going on that creates opportunities for people like us to be in elected office." January 2023 would have marked 50 years of Roe versus Wade, the landmark 1973 court ruling legalizing abortions. This past June, the current majority conservative Supreme Court overturned the decision, unnerving citizens nationwide. The consequences have been swift and unrelenting. Children impregnated by pedophiles have become the center of polarizing political conversations, rather than being seen exclusively as the victims of a sickening crime. In all of our glorious dancing and dressing and marching and running for political office, the societal needle has moved little in 50 years. Has it been here all along, this falsified progress? I believe we felt just enough change to keep pushing, but enough unrest to wail. Each decade, we hope against hope that we are wiser than the people before us. We study their pitfalls, their fears, and their desires. With the world at our fingertips, we puff out our chest, confident we can do better, confident we can be better. But the systems that fettered our ancestors chain us to maybe a renaissance, a fist in the air do-over is exactly what we need. The next article is titled, "Buying Back the Block." These black change makers are developing black-owned neighborhoods and businesses in their hometowns. For decades, home ownership has been the primary contributor to wealth building for black households. Now, as the racial climate in the United States continues to shift, home ownership remains one of the most promising ways to build multi-generational wealth and housing stability for households of color. In short, economic empowerment is not just a worthy goal for our community, but a necessity. Unfortunately, access to equitable home ownership is often lacking due to a long history of structural discrimination and financial barriers that consistently shut out Black applicants. This has played out over the past few decades in communities such as Washington, D.C. and Brooklyn, where long-standing families and community members have been and continue to be denied this opportunity for wealth building. Indeed, racial gaps in home ownership continue to widen this year as home prices hit record-breaking highs. McKinsey and Company, the global management consulting group, estimated a $330 billion disparity between Black and white families in the annual flow of new wealth, with 60% of that coming from inheritance. And a recent study by LendingTree examined census records to determine how the share of homes owned by Black people in the nation's 50 largest metro areas compared with the Black population in those cities. The study found that in every city, Black residents own a disproportionately small share of homes when sized up with their population. Thankfully, a group of Black entrepreneurs is trying to change that narrative by buying up entire blocks in their local communities and educating others so they can acquire the knowledge and resources to do the same. These efforts will have an impact that ripples down through generations, not just for the home buyers themselves, but for the hundreds of wealth builders they end up serving. Antonio Buchanan, for example, is not only a real estate investor, he also advises individuals on how to grow wealth through real estate. With 33 of his own units across 5 states, Mississippi, Indiana, Virginia, Maryland, and Wisconsin, Buchanan is equipped with the investing experience to provide valuable knowledge to beginner, intermediate, and expert real estate investors. I have a responsibility to educate and empower next generations, Buchanan says. It's knowledge that wasn't taught in school nor in households. So where else will they get the information? It's hard to believe he does all of this as his side hustle. The budding real estate mogul and founder of Capstone Investment Group also works full-time as a chief architect at Microsoft. When he's not investing in real estate, he's coaching clients toward achieving their goals and documenting his journey through his book, Building Wealth Through Real Estate with AB. I know that every person dreams of the day they can retire and travel the world, he says. But what if they can do that in their 20s, 30s, 40s, instead of 50s and 60s? When I was growing up, we were only taught to save, never to invest. You can't generate passive income by saving. I mean, you can, but it will be at a 0.25% interest rate. This is why I coach people to invest in real estate, helping them create the life that they want to live. Baltimore residents Kyra and Khalil are also on a mission to increase home ownership for people of color. The husband and wife co-founders of Charm City Buyers launched their multi-million dollar real estate development firm specializing in Baltimore properties. They also run the Next Gen Accelerator program, which has helped hundreds of mentees across the country find, finance, and renovate investment properties in 6 months or less. Kyra and Khalil started investing in real estate about a year after college in September 2012. Within 6 months, they had their first property under contract, a three-unit building in need of a $120,000 renovation. From that moment, they were hooked. Their goal had been not just to build wealth for themselves, but also to help like-minded Black millennials, as well as people in their 60s and 70s, access the knowledge and resources they wished they'd had when acquiring their first new properties. With over 65,000 followers on Instagram, the couple continues to spread their wealth, building gospel in Baltimore and across the nation. We believe we are writing our chapter in the history of Baltimore City real estate, says Kyra. By transforming how developers consider the bottom line of investing, impact, and profit, we can truly shift what it looks like to develop properties in Baltimore and other cities. For Bonita Harris and her development partners, Sean Jones, Daquan Robinson, Keith Lindsay, and Derek Walker, the mission is to boost Black home ownership in order to close the racial wealth gap. We asked ourselves, what can we do to really move the needle? Says Harrison. We all own property throughout the South Side, and it helps, but what if we could concentrate our efforts on one block? This would cause a real shift while also building equity and morale within a community. It would encourage the people of the community to stay within the community and not feel the need to leave for a better neighborhood. Once they become college educated and get a good job, we need the doctors, lawyers, teachers, and police to stay inside these communities to influence the next generations of leaders. But to do that, we have to make their communities attractive and marketable. We answer that question, she continues, by building better quality housing in the same neighborhoods we were born and raised in, and we took pride in that. To date, her group has contributed over $150 million to Black wealth on the South Side of Chicago and $2 million. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.